Hello, I'm Anthony DP Man. This is number 0350, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0350. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet journalist Christian Gravener from the blog Coolopolis. He talks about the Montreal woman who has now been identified as a Manson family murder victim.
47 years, 46 years, you know, there's been no sign of her. And of course, people probably assume she was dead, but there was always hope. So there was never any mention of her. I don't know why she was never reported missing. Her name, just like her, disappeared from the face of the earth very suddenly, and it has only been now discovered where she went.
We remember Arthur Anderson, who recently passed away. He was an actor since childhood on stage, in radio, and TV, and he was also the voice of the Lucky Charms leprechaun for almost three decades.
Always after me Lucky Charms, the new old cereal, sweet surprises. Pink hearts, yellow moons, green clovers, and new blue diamonds. Oh, the kids are coming. I'll turn myself into a bulldozer and get away. Frosted Lucky Charms, the magically delicious.
Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman. Book Banter goes back to Yankee Stadium in 1960 as George Plimpton steps up to the mound with Out of My League. So it's batter up time right here on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0350 was filmmaker Anthony D.P. Mann. You can check out his work at his website, which is anthonydpman.com, and man is with two N's. That's anthonydpman.com. Anthony does some really interesting work that deals with the macabre and the scary and Sherlock Holmes and the classics and old-time radio. He's a renaissance guy for the modern era. So that's Anthony D.P. Mann, and the website is anthonydpman with two N's on the end.com. Thank you very much, Anthony, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? You know, Robert E. Lee Elementary in Austin, Texas, is named for the Confederate Civil War general. Now, the school board voted to rename the school and made the unwise decision to solicit suggestions on the internet for new names. Leading so far, Donald J. Trump Elementary. Other suggested names include Adolf Hitler School for Friendship and Tolerance, Forgetting the Past Dooms You to Repeat It Elementary, Hypothetical Perfect Person Memorial Elementary School, and in a nod to the attempt to name a British ship Bodie McBoatface, Schooly McSchoolerson. Well, no matter what the new name is, the result is Robert E. Lee lost again. Also, these are the kind of names you will end up with if you allow the general public to vote. That's something dictators the world over have known for centuries. Now, according to witnesses, 36-year-old Dante Anderson walked into a Carl's Jr. restaurant in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, where he screamed at employees to give him food. Unsuccessful in his quest, Anderson moved to an Arby's, where he again screamed for food. Police say that he jumped over the counter, walked into the kitchen, forced an employee against the wall, grabbed a handful of bacon and chicken, and walked out, allegedly breaking the restaurant door as he left. Police later found Anderson lying on the ground outside a Taco Mayo restaurant. "I got bacon and chicken, and I scared the lady," Anderson reportedly told an officer. "She thought I was going to hurt her, but I was not." Anderson also allegedly admitted to kicking several cars and explained, "I am from planet Earth 2016, and I am 4 years advanced on you, and you guys are always trying to kill me." Well, I guess the planet Earth he's from has forgotten how to do simple math. Anyway, Anderson added that on my planet Earth, everyone is dead, and I've walked here from there. You know, he could have made the trip a lot quicker if he just simply used his DeLorean. Yeah. A California woman captured video of another motorist walking her dog by holding its leash out of the car while driving down a Stockton road. Amanda Brachkovich captured video showing part of her confrontation with the motorist she encountered on a Stockton street holding onto her dog's leash while the canine was walking next to the car. The video shows Amanda asking the woman why she's using the unusual dog walking method, and the driver defends the practice, saying the dog wasn't being dragged. Amanda's video shows the motorist speed up, forcing the dog to run along beside the car to avoid being dragged. Philip Zimmerman, director of Stockton's Animal Services Department, said he found the video distressing. The Stockton Police Department said officers reviewed the video and did not believe there was evidence of animal cruelty, but officials said the motorist would have been charged with distracted driving if she had been seen by an officer. You know, clearly, this is a woman who was inspired by Chevy Chase's dog leash scene in National Lampoon's Vacation. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, police in Oregon said they arrested a pet store owner accused of using store funds to pay a prostitute and tipping the woman with a bush baby. Oh, I'll just leave that line alone. The Eugene Police Department said the Galago, most commonly known as a bush baby, was reported stolen from the Zany Zoo pet store in Eugene during reported burglaries March 1st and March 6th, but the prostitute found in possession of the primate at a hotel said the animal was given to her by the store's owner. The woman, said Nathan Allen McLean, used store funds, including donation jar money for the Girl Guides, oh, there's a special place in hell for him, to pay for her services, and the bush baby was just simply a tip. McLean told detectives that he used deposit and donation money from the store to pay the prostitute. The bush baby, named Gooey, yeah, was taken to a nearby sanctuary while the Zany Zoo pet store applies for a new exotic animal license. Here is the quote of the day from police detective Rick Lowe. It's my first time ever recovering a monkey from a prostitute. Yeah, you don't hear that line very often, do you? Okay, I've never used a prostitute, so I was unaware of the fact that they also take non-monetary tips. Oh, and if you're looking for an exotic pet, would you buy anything from a place called Zany Zoo Pet Store? That sounds like you're asking for trouble, doesn't it? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Last week, news broke that an unidentified woman who is thought to have been a victim of the Manson family murderers in L.A. back in 1969 was actually a free-spirited Montrealer who went to California. While many publications are climbing over each other to bring out the story, it is the tenacious digging of a journalist and blogger here in Montreal who uncovered the story. Christian Gravener's blog is called Coolopolis, and Christian has a nose for reporting on Montreal history and also crime. He joins us on the line right now from here in Montreal. Hi, Christian.
Yes, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. So how did you come across this story that has basically been uncovered or unknown for the last 40-odd years?
Yes, it's most incredible, isn't it? It's when I first started looking into this, it was basically I was on a misguided quest to find something, some other piece of information, as so many of these serendipitous discoveries tend to go. So I was phoning a friend about an entirely different subject, whereupon she started telling me this story, and as she was going along, I didn't understand what exactly she was talking about, because it just seemed so large and vast and incredible when you hear mentions of the Manson family murder, unsolved conspiracy, Montreal, beautiful young lady who finally, oh my gosh, when I, so basically it became it became clear to me after she pretty much laid it out to me. So I think you overstate how much tenacious digging I did, but it was quite a shocker to me, just as anybody who read it.
Now, why hadn't this story, do you have any speculation as to why this story hadn't come out before?
Well, first of all, I believe that the LA police have had for almost 1 year knowledge of this young lady's identity. It was, of course, I'll bring you back to the very beginning. The whole story starts with a beautiful young woman from NDG, a borough of near downtown Montreal, who was of Estonian heritage, and she was an absolutely special girl in every way. She was great at school. She was lovely friend to her friends. She had a lot of friends at the Estonian church near her home. And she, of course, was like a lot of those young ladies in the early 60s, very full of life and vivacious and entering the world. She would go to this bar as an underager, which was common practice, called Cafe Prague. It was a restaurant run by a very kindly man named Kurt Sperlich. And he ran the most popular place in town, where every sort of hipster beatnik of those era, whatever you'd call it, mods, they would hang around, and it was a real hot spot. You know, the singer Robert Charlebois was there. You had great playwrights. Leonard Cohen supposedly wrote Suzanne at that very place. So it was a real hot spot, and that is where she met a young man named Jean. Now, very little is known about Jean, and he's one of the central focuses of this whole mystery, because he had a look like Jim Morrison of the Doors, and of course, our lovely loved him. So ultimately what happened is, they became lovers. And she also had a corresponding desire to move to California.
And we should mention her name. Her name is Reed Jurvetson, right?
Yes, indeed. It's a very rare name. In fact, people who have been Googling her disappearances were only able to find another person in Estonia with that same name, obviously not the same person. So, 46 years, I guess, there's been no sign of her. And, of course, people probably assume she was dead, but there was always hope. So there was never any mention of her. I don't know why she was never reported missing. But, yeah, that's a very rare name. And it just, like her name, just like her, disappeared from the face of the earth very suddenly, and it has only been now discovered where she went.
Now, as you said, we don't understand why she wasn't reported missing. I've been hearing stuff, and also, again, looking at your blog, Coolopolis, which is a great source of information, wasn't it believed that she was such a free spirit, she went off to California, that people just thought she was living her life and wasn't calling her family and friends back home?
Well, that is indeed an interesting theory, but my contact, who I don't believe has spoken to other media yet, even though I don't discourage from doing it, but she told me that she was very close friends with Reed, and she said that there's no way that she was a sociable person. There's no way that she would have just fallen off the map for 50 years like that. It's inconceivable. However, there is an element, of course, of truth in that she sought to hitchhike all the way to California, and her friends told her, hey, don't do that, you'll get killed, which, of course, was a very kind of sad, foreboding statement, considering her ultimate tragic fate.
Now that the story is broken, does she still have family in Montreal, and if so, are they saying anything?
Unfortunately, her parents... the same parents who, for reasons, I suppose, deeply rooted in their own psychological response to this tragedy, the same parents who did not report her officially missing, they've long since passed on, and very sadly, I guess they never really knew what their daughter's fate was. I'm told that she has a sister in Three Rivers, Quebec, who... she has, issued a statement. From what I'm told, she, and in the statement, it even reflects that she feels a lot of regret over the fact that there, the missing element, she was not mentioned as missing. So that she is out there and has asked that her privacy be respected and has issued a statement. And I believe the niece is also involved in handling this as well. So her family is, not exactly extensive.
I take it since you broke this story that you yourself have been getting a little attention. What's that been like?
Well, I have been, receiving quite a flood of requests for contact information and any other tips that I might have about this. I am not personally a super expert in the Manson family history. I'm not a freak for the details, but of course that is the other element that people are very interested in. Insofar as her death corresponds about 2 months after the terrible Manson family killings of Sharon Tate and the couple of the next night. And of course the location was not far. Of course, one of the biographers specifically stated that this young lady who had been designated Jane Doe number 59 might have been killed due to having been a witness of a death. So that's a rather, convoluted theory. Who knows, could be right. But that, of course, remains to be seen. And the good news, I suppose, is that investigators will finally have some sort of thing to work on with, even though perhaps many of the people are no longer alive, the possible suspects. But at least they have a name and can try to trace through her acquaintances. And from what I'm told, they're quite interested in finding this man named Jean, who the Jim Morrison character I mentioned, who she went to visit in Los Angeles, and another man named Jean. But I just want to make it clear that I'm not saying they are suspects in any way, but I'm told that they want to interview them at the very least, and that I have been looking for them.
Well, it's a most interesting story that we're going to hear, I'm sure, more and more of over the next coming days and weeks. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Christian. I just want to mention very quickly, I know you're working on a book about Montreal. How's that going? And when will we be able to see that?
Well, thanks for your interest. Yes, I'm working on an epic book about Montreal weird history and a catalog of old nostalgic places. And I've put a lot of attention and care into it. It's tentatively titled Montreal 375 Tales of Eating, Drinking, Living, and Loving. And I believe I should be good to have it out in September, perhaps October. So I'm really quite excited. And I believe that anybody listening should give serious consideration to buying this book when it comes out.
And when it does come out, will you come back on the show and talk to us about it?
Oh, I'd love to. I'd be so thrilled. Thank you very much for your invitation and your concern.
Excellent. And people can find out more information by going to your website, which is your blog, rather, coulopolis.blogspot.ca. Christian, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Journalist Christian Gravener. You can check out his blog at coulopolis.blogspot.ca. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0350, and you'll find the link.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come on the program, we'll have another edition of Book Banter with Stuart Nallman. Plus, we remember the late actor Arthur Andersen. That's coming up in just a matter of moments. But first, a few more Stuff File news stories here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. You know, one notable hyper-successful YouTube channel, which has 700,000 subscribers, features a guy in Finland pulverizing various objects, such as a bowling ball, with a 100-ton hydraulic press. I actually checked out this guy's page, and on YouTube, he's very enthusiastic about the fact that he's the eighth most popular YouTube channel in all of Finland, which leads me to ask, who are the other seven? Anyway, he goes on to say, "I think it's built into every person the need to destroy something." Well, no truer words have ever been said. That channel is free of charge, but other entrepreneurs have created 24-hour pay-per-month websites and apps offering similarly specialized programming. For example, Zombie Go Boom, actors taking chainsaws to things, and you can pay $5 for that particular site per month. Hungry Monk Yoga, posing in orange robes while teaching martial arts, that'll cost you $15 a month. And lather fantasies, clothed people excessively shampooing each other's hair, and for that you'll pay $20 a month. An April Wall Street Journal report noted that the lather channel sounds kinkier than it actually is. The folks at the Wall Street Journal seem genuinely disappointed about that statement, which may say a lot more about them than it does about lather fantasies. Meanwhile, in January, four units in an apartment house in Midtown Detroit were accidentally burned out by a tenant attempting to kill a bedbug that had bitten him. He had tried to light it up, but by the time the flames were extinguished, he was badly burned. His and three adjacent units were uninhabitable, and two dozen others had suffered water damage. Okay, the story states he attempted to kill the bedbug. It doesn't explain if he was successful or not. You know, inquiring minds need to know. And what is believed to be the longest-running armed standoff in U.S. history came to a quiet conclusion back in January, on the 6th of that month, in Trinidad, Texas, when John Joe Gray outlasted the district attorney, never having left his 47-acre ranch in the past 15 years. In 1999, Gray, carrying a pistol but without a permit, resisted arrest and bit a state trooper, retreating to his property, refusing to leave for the court. The sheriff, explaining why his deputies declined to go after him, once said, "Joe Gray has been in prison out there by himself for 14 years. Actually, the charges were dismissed in December of 2014, but when the district attorney left office, he failed to notify Gray or the deputies. Now, that's the definition of a stubborn homebody, isn't it? Yeah. And a Pennsylvania man has pleaded guilty to what his attorney called a crime of stupidity, burglarizing a neighbor's home by cutting a hole in the wall between his basement and the neighbor's. Public defender Anthony Ryback told the Northampton County judge he didn't see how anyone could think he'd get away with such a crime. The Allentown Morning Call says that's why 22-year-old Sammy Paul Buskirk pleaded guilty to burglary, telling the judge he's a heroin addict. Buskirk acknowledged sawing through his wall on December 4th to create a hole to get into his neighbor's home, where he stole $200 worth of quarters. The judge sentenced Buskirk to 3 months in jail, followed by 5 years of probation, which will include long-term inpatient drug treatment. Yeah, but who's going to pay for the hole in the wall? That's what I want to know. And finally, in this section of Stuff All News, before we get to a remembrance of the late actor Arthur Andersen. Fearing Snapchat could take an ugly turn towards Snapchomp, police are warning people not to take selfies with an alligator in suburban Atlanta. Peachtree police also advise residents not to feed the 6-foot gator known as Flat Creek Floyd, as he soaks in the sun and Flat Creek about 30 miles southwest of downtown Atlanta. Peachtree City Police Lieutenant Mark Brown says that the gator's presence has gone a little crazy on social media. Police say that when Floyd was spotted earlier this month, it was the first alligator sighting in the area in 5 years. Gators are common in parts of South Georgia, but are not usually seen in metro Atlanta. You know, this is the sad reality about the dumbing down of the population and the rush to take selfies in dangerous situations. The fact that police have to warn people against taking selfies with alligators in the wild is shocking. Apparently, all the cops are doing is stepping in the way of natural selection. Today's moronic selfie taker is tomorrow's Darwin file participant. Wait a minute. Maybe I'm looking at this through a totally personal and selfish lens. My bad.
This is the Stuff File.
It's time for another retro interview with a celebrity that we have recently lost. This time around, it's Arthur Andersen. He may not have been a household name, but he certainly was a household voice. Arthur, who was 93 when he passed away on April the 9th in Manhattan, performed on radio as a teenager with Orson Welles' Mercury Theater, and appeared on Broadway, in films, and on television. But his most endearing role was as the voice of the Lucky Charms cereal's Leprechaun. Those who know me know that I have a passion for old-time radio, which Arthur was a major part of. He was also the author of the book Let's Pretend and the Golden Age of Radio. Let's Pretend was a major network radio show back in the day that he was a child star on. I spoke with Arthur back in October of 2004, and here is part of that interview now. You have been acting for a long, long time.
Yes.
You were a child actor.
The first time I was paid for acting, I was 12 years old on radio in NBC Studios in Rockefeller Center. It was called Radio City then. And, of course, by the changes in radio, it's now Rockefeller Center. The only radio in that neighborhood is the Radio City Music Hall. Sort of ironic, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
But that's when I started getting paid for acting, and I've always loved it, and I still do.
Now, you were on a show called Let's Pretend.
Yes. A year after my first broadcast, I was hired for a program called Let's Pretend, which was dramatizing the classic fairy tales on Columbia Broadcasting with a cast consisting entirely of children. And this was directed by a lady who had been a vaudeville actress and a stage actress, and a depression came along, and she was out of work, and she got a job, a offer from CBS to direct pro radio, and she jumped at it. But there was one uh-oh. The uh-oh was it was children's programming, and she said to herself, I don't know anything about children. I don't even like children. But she took the job, and she found that she did like children, and she formed a completely new and very successful program.
Let's talk about the book you have, which is Let's Pretend in the Good Old Days of Radio.
The Golden Age of Radio.
And the Golden Age of Radio.
And it was a golden age because during the late 20s and the 30s and the 40s into the 50s, that was when radio was at its peak. And I think American and I'm sure Canadian life, to a great extent, revolved around radio. People, they scheduled their days around radio. And in the morning, they used it to get up, and of course they still do, to wake up. And then the housewives, of course, there were a lot more housewives in those days, they whiled away the time with the soap operas, for Front Page Peril and Our Gal Sunday and Aunt Jenny's Real Life Stories. And then the afternoon, the kids came home from school, and they listened to the children's programs. And in the evening, the whole family gathered around the big Philco or Majestic or whatever it was and listened to Burns and Allen or The Shadow or The Lone Ranger. And radio, as I like to say, radio saw us through, you and me, saw us through a major depression, and it saw us through a world war. And people gathered around the radio for encouragement and for news.
Now, you know, you talk about it very nostalgically and with a lot of love. Were you aware at the time that you were doing it of the impact that you had on people's lives who were listening to the radio at home?
No, I was not. It was just a big, always a big adventure. And, of course, kids, the reason Nyla Mack chose children for her actors was because she said children have an openness and an innocence, and they don't know enough to over-dramatize it. And she ran a tight ship. But the children were fearful and loving. They loved her, and some of them feared her, and some of us both at the same time. No, I don't think we didn't know enough to be nervous. We just enjoyed it. And during the Depression, I must add, there were many times when the kids' earnings were the entire family's income because Dad was out of a job. And the mothers were wildly anxious to get the kid on the radio because that's where the money was. However, Let's Pretend was different. We were sustaining, which means we were not sponsored. And we got, for a coast-to-coast broadcast, I don't know, 100 and 200 stations, with 4 hours rehearsal, we got $3.50. We didn't mind. The parents loved it because Let's Pretend was a stepping stone to many other programs for the child and the family.
Right, that was long before AFTRA, wasn't it?
The AFTRA came aboard in 1937.
Okay,
but even after that, the networks were able to get a contract with the union saying that if more than 75% of the cast were children, they didn't have to pay union scale, because this was compared to the little kiddie hour where you would sing or do a tap dance or play the accordion. Oh, isn't that cute? And you didn't expect to be paid for that, did you? But of course, finally, we grew up and started dating and getting married and having children, and by then, there was no more $3.50. Then we were sponsored by Cream of Wheat.
Now, I unfortunately did not have the opportunity to live through the golden age of radio, although
just,
I am a...
Just be glad you're that young.
Although I have been for quite some time a collector of what's considered old-time radio and enjoy it quite a bit. But one thing I do know you from is a certain series of television commercials that ran on Saturday mornings and other times all through my childhood.
Ah, yes.
Yes, you were the original voice of the Lucky Charms Leprechaun.
That is true. For 29 years, can you believe that?
Wow.
29 years.
How did you get that gig?
The casting director of that particular ad agency knew the actors who usually did what are called voiceovers, and she called me in, and I auditioned for the Leprechaun. And then they had what's called a callback, which means some people, they'd say, no, that he's no good, but we'll call back so-and-so. And then they had two more callbacks, and the last callback was I auditioned for the president of General Mills, a handsome old man with silver hair and blue eyes and gold-rimmed glasses. And, of course, what did he know about actors? But if he had said no, that would have been it. But he apparently liked my Leprechaun.
Now, what was distinct about your Leprechaun? Did you know what others had done in their audition or not?
No, because it's usually done in a closed studio and the others wait outside. So, and it's funny that on Let's Pretend, the many years I was on it, 18 by the way, I had never done any Irish parts. But this time, they want a Leprechaun. And they probably showed us pictures of what the Leprechaun was going to look like,
mm-hmm,
so that we would get an idea. And so I just went in and did it and did it and did it and finally got it. And this was a month after I was married, so the best wedding present I can imagine getting. But would you like to hear what the Leprechaun said?
Absolutely.
Always after me, Lucky Charms, the new old cereal, sweet surprises, pink hearts, yellow moons, green clovers, and new blue diamonds. Oh, the kids are coming. I'll turn myself into a bulldozer and get away. Frosted Lucky Charms, the magically delicious.
Amazing.
More or less like that. Each commercial, the kids try to catch Lucky because he has Lucky Charms, and he always uses the magic to get away, and the magic always goes wrong, and he gets caught anyway, but he doesn't mind because he loves the children. And all this whole drama takes place in 30 seconds.
Now, you could never have possibly imagined when you first got that gig that it would last for 29 years.
I did not. I did not at all. And I never even had a contract. It was completely freelance. When they called me, I did it. When they didn't call me, I didn't do it. And I will just tell you, how long do we have? I just want to see how many stories I can tell.
Oh, we got about 10 minutes.
Oh, okay. one story connected with the leprechaun.
Yep.
There was a long time when I didn't get called to the leprechaun. I thought, oh, God, what's gone wrong? I found out that they were trying out another spokesman. They were trying out a wizard who got things wrong. And they would try this out in a test market, like one city, to see if people liked the wizard better than the leprechaun. Well, after months, I finally got called for the leprechaun again. I was afraid to ask any questions. I did the session, I did my commercial, and I went into the control room when it was over. Deed Meyer was the director. I said, Deed, what's this all about? I'm getting called again. What happened to the wizard? He said, Arthur, the wizard is dead. Thank you, God.
Now, after doing it for 29 years, as I said, you couldn't possibly imagine it would go on for that long. Was there a time when you thought, well, this could go on forever?
I guess I just took it for granted. I guess that's what I do about acting, about maybe about my whole life, maybe it's too much. I just take one day at a time, and I really drive my wife crazy sometimes because I don't plan enough for tomorrow. But that's the way I took it as it came. And finally, it didn't come. But I said to myself, 29 years, I can't complain.
Not at all.
People would say, well, listen, do they send you Lucky Charms, boxes of Lucky Charms? I say, no, they just send money.
Well, there you go. You can buy all the Lucky Charms you want.
Exactly.
In addition to doing that radio show for 18 years, in addition to being the leprechaun, the original Lucky Charms leprechaun for 29 years, you were also part of the Mercury Theater Troupe.
Yes, I was. When I was, I guess, 14, sort of that terrible in-between age, I was hired by Orson Welles for his spectacular modern dress production of Julius Caesar. And he played Brutus, and I was the boy, Lucius, Brutus's servant. And that was a wonderful adventure.
Now, I'm thinking back to some of the people I know who were in the Mercury Theater Troupe. You had people like, of course, Orson Welles, Joseph Cotten.
Agnes Moorehead,
Ruth Warwick,
yeah.
Right, Warwick. And I'm just thinking, those are pretty imposing characters to be around when you're a 14-year-old.
Well, I wasn't intimidated by them, and I wasn't intimidated by Orson either, because I was, at 14, I was pretty much a child, and he was always... Orson could be, he was a supreme egotist and a genius talent, but he was always kind to me. And they would be rehearsing till 3 in the morning. The heck with the union rules. The actors were loyal to Orson, and they would rehearse as long as he wanted. And he would speak to actors twice his age and give them notes and scold them and say, shame on you. And they would take it from him because he was Orson. And he would see me sitting in the corner of the theater at 3 a.m. and say, dear boy, go home, dear boy. And then on radio, the Mercury Theater on the Air, I did Jim Hawkins, the lead in Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. And then he did Sherlock Holmes, and I was Billy the Postboy, and Life with Father, and more adventures.
Besides,
I must say that,
yes?
In contrast to Dick Van Patten, I am what's called a working actor. By that I mean I've never been starred, I've never been featured, and on radio, you never knew my name because they didn't announce names. We did on Let's Pretend, yes. But the soap operas, you never knew who the actor was, but all I knew was that I was working.
Now, in addition to writing the book, are you still working these days?
Not much. I do the convention in Newark,
mm-hmm,
in October. I do another something similar in Brockton, Massachusetts in May. And I may be in Elmore and Myra, New York in April. I have done some television recently. I've done 3 Law and Orders, and this gives work to a lot of New York actors, and I've been cut out of one of them. But... So every time they play my Law and Order, I get a small check. And people call up and say, hey, I saw you on Law and Order. It's great for the ego. But I like to work. Don't get me wrong. But I don't financially need to tread the pavements and look for work. And I'm not that assiduous about striving for it.
Well, I mentioned last week when we had Dick Van Patten on the program that he seemed to be enjoying every moment of what he does and what he has done. And it sounds like it's the same situation with you. You clearly had a love and a passion for the work you did as a child actor. And considering that it's the job you had basically all your life and you were happy with it, yes. Who could ask for anything more?
Well, I don't know. I'm also in good health. Oh, before I go and you go, I do want to mention one thing that your listeners may be interested in, and that's that nobody spoke on radio after Marconi invented the telegraph. You could hear dit-dot, dit-dot, dit-dot over the air, but that's all you could hear until a man named Reginald Fessenden first transmitted the human voice over the airways, and he was born in Canada.
Yep.
1902. Well, you knew that.
Mm-hmm. I thank you very, very much, Arthur, for being on the program with us. The book is called Let's Pretend and the Golden Age of Radio.
Yep.
And you can find more about the book at bearmannermedia.com.
That is true.
Thank you very much.
I usually sign off by saying, this is the Irrational Broadcasting System.
Oh, okay. I like that one.
All right.
Can we have a little bit more of the Leprechaun before you go?
Oh, listen. You may, and then we will fade out on the Let's Pretend opening theme, which I have queued up. But here's the Leprechaun. Lucky, are you over there? Always have to be Lucky Charms, the new old cereal with sweet surprises: pink hearts, yellow moons, new blue diamonds. Oh, the kids are coming. I'll turn myself into a bulldozer and get away, because here comes Let's Pretend. What am I gonna do?
And as the music of Let's Pretend fades out, we remember actor Arthur Andersen, who seemed to enjoy life right to the end. He had a passion for acting and a passion for paying homage to an industry that gave him so much joy. Arthur Andersen died at 93 on April 9th in New York. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Actually, it's our 350th edition of Let's Be Fair. So after more than 6 years of looking at America's legal system, let's do something a little different. Let's look at the legal situation in another economic power, Japan. The Wall Street Journal reports that Japan is struggling with a very unusual problem. It says, and I quote, "Its people aren't litigious enough," end of quote. That's right. Some Japanese experts actually think they need more lawsuits. Why? Well, 15 years ago, officials there started using law schools in the United States as a model for educating their lawyers. They were able to recruit more students, but public attitudes on suing one another didn't change. Japanese people like resolving conflicts privately, so now they have a lot of lawyers with nothing to do. Let's be fair, is that really a problem? Here in the U.S., it was once reported that we have 30 times more lawsuits per person than Japan. Now that's a litigation problem. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses, but recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And with an edition of Stars on Ice, Stuart Nauman brings us books from dead people. Hi, Stu.
I thought you were going to talk about that figure skating show that Alex Trebek hosted no. back in the 70s.
No, I mean real stars on real ice.
this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look at a book that was written by a star who's no longer with us. But this time it's on the ice. It's on the baseball diamond, actually. But let me preface that, you know, for those sports fans who are not natural-born athletes, it's always been a much-dreamed-about fantasy to emulate their favorite sports heroes by suiting up in the uniform of their favorite pro sports team, playing in the middle of their team's venerable home stadium, come shrine, and perform so extraordinarily that their team will win that much-sought-out championship. Now, but what happens when you get the chance to realize that sports fan's ultimate on-field fantasy and live to write all about it? And that's how the late George Plimpton carved an unusual yet very interesting journalistic career during the 60s and 70s. So he took the concept of participatory journalism, which was pioneered during the 20s by Paul Gallico, who dared to go into the ring for a few rounds with then heavyweight champion Jack Dempsey. And he brought it to a whole new level by taking a much more experimental approach to participatory journalism. This time, he decided to be a professional athlete for a day and see what the world of baseball, football, hockey, golf, and boxing is all about from the athlete's point of view. The result ended up in the pages of such magazines as Sports Illustrated and Esquire, and later transcended into memorable best-selling books such as Paper Lion, The Bogeyman, and Open Net. But this year, 55 years after the first book, Out of My League, was published, Little Brown has decided to reissue Plimpton's famous 7 sports-related participatory journalistic books in brand-new hardcover editions with new introductions by some of today's best-known sports journalists such as Bob Costas and Jane Levy, who wrote an excellent book about Sandy Koufax. So, Out of My League, which was published in 1961, was done in the form of a challenge made by Sports Illustrated in the summer of 1960 and was later turned into an article that Plimpton would take the mound at Yankee Stadium before a second All-Star game was to take place and would pitch a full pregame exhibition inning in front of an impressive roster of National League and American League All-Stars such as Willie Mays, Frank Robinson, Mickey Mantle, Nellie Fox, Billy Martin, and Ernie Banks. And whichever league's All-Stars got the most number of hits off Plimpton during their half of that inning would divide up a cash prize of $1,000 that was furnished by the magazine. And don't forget, back in 1960, $1,000 was a nice chunk of change. Absolutely. So the narrative of this book is written with a great deal of insight, perception, and one man's true passion for the game of baseball. Plimpton gives the reader the pressures one feels about the preparation of a pitcher, that what he has to go through before making that pitching start on the mound. He gives a lot of introspection to some of these all-stars, some of whom would later be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame, that he faces on that hot summer day at Yankee Stadium, and what motivates them to play this game, what shapes their skills and their characters. One thing that struck me amongst one of the observations that Plimpton makes in Out of My League, that he marveled at how the batting stance of Philadelphia Phillies' Stan Lapata, get this, Peter, resembled that of Eddie Goodell, the midget who had a single career at-bat for the St. Louis Browns back in 1951.
I'm sure Lapata was thrilled with the comparison.
Yeah, and I bet you he hit one right out of the park as a result. But at first glance, Out of My League may read like a fish-out-of-water story, but it satisfyingly fulfills that professional baseball fantasy that we all have of having that once-in-a-lifetime chance to become a legendary Hall of Fame player with a Hall of Fame career in their own field of dreams. And for George Plimpton, it was the beginning of a journalistic career that sports fans long envied about.
Now, I'm just curious, do you think that George Plimpton could be, in one way, shape, or form, the original Anderson Cooper? And the reason why I say that, you have two guys who are extremely good journalists who come from a blue blood background.
That could be so. I mean, like I said, before Plimpton, participatory journalism wasn't done, you know, it was done in the 20s with Paul Gallico. And I don't think it had, you know, I think it was just basically sort of like a, how can I say, a one-shot thing.
Right.
That Gallico didn't decide to, you know, go, you know, be with the Yankees and learn to hit like Babe Ruth. So, yeah, I mean, maybe, you know, Plimpton could have set the tone for what Anderson Cooper has done this day.
Yeah. Now, the book again is?
It's called Out of My League. It's a new edition by George Plimpton and with a introduction by Jane Levy, and it's published by Little Brown, and it's $24.
And what do you suggest, perhaps in a similar vein, maybe even participatory journalism?
Well, George Plimpton-wise, let's recommend his most famous book, Paper Lion, which was published in 1965, and it dealt with Plimpton, you know, tackling professional football. This time, you know, spending 3 weeks in the Detroit Lions training camp in the early 60s and also getting a chance to, you know, spend, you know, doing a round of calls, you know, plays, you know, on field at exhibition game between the Lions and the Rams. I mean, this was in the early 60s. The book was published in 65, became a huge bestseller, and a movie with Alan Alda in 1968. And for participatory journalism, I think the classic has to be Black Like Me by John Howard Griffin, which was published in 1960. And he was a white journalist and decided to, you know, color his skin black to see what it was like to be, you know, an African-American in the Deep South, you know, in 1959, you know, on the eve of the height of the civil rights movement.
Yeah, I still see that as a failed experiment. But anyway, that's just me.
Yeah.
Participatory journalism, say that fast five times. You mentioned Alan Alda. I thought that was perfect casting to play George Plimpton. Both very gangly looking guys.
Oh, yes, yeah. That's true. And well, and also, you think I saw the movie once. I thought it was pretty good. It was almost looked like a docudrama.
Yeah. Anyway, sir, how can people find you?
Well, you're not going to find me in Fenway Park or Yankee Stadium, that's for sure. But you're going to find me in the Montreal Times every week in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
You're welcome, Peter, and batter up.
Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just into the home stretch here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a matter of moments, but I got a couple of things I want to share with you before we get to that. We just spoke to Stuart Nullman about books, of course, and earlier in the program, we had an older interview that I did several years ago with Arthur Anderson, who unfortunately passed away in April. And in the interview with Arthur, he also mentioned a book that he had written called Let's Pretend and the Golden Age of Radio. And it was published by Bear Manor Media. And it just so happens I have a book that will be coming out that deals with celebrity interviews that will also be published by Bear Manor Media. And I'll have more to tell you on that as the project progresses. I'm almost finished writing the book, but there's still a lot of work to do. So when I have more concrete details as to the date of the release of the book and more on the book, I'll be sure to let you know right here on the Stuff File program. And also another thing I want to mention that we love to hear from you at the Stuff File program. So send me an email with your thoughts or questions about the show and we'll respond. Just email me at peter@thestufffile.com. And some of the questions might even make it onto the air in our mailbag section. Also, Facebook users, we urge you to join the Stuff File fan page. It's easy to find. It's at facebook.com/thestufffileprogram. We'd love to have you as part of the fun because the more the merrier. And remember, this show is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, boys and girls, it's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
Very few believed it when they saw the report widely circulated on Facebook last month. Breaking news: area meth and heroin supply possibly contaminated with Ebola. As if that were remotely possible. The warning issued by the Granite Shoals, Texas Police Department advised druggies worried about their stash to contact any Granite Shoals PD officer for testing. The report also noted that police had a special device to check for Ebola. While just about everyone rolled their eyes, 29-year-old Chastity Hobson brought in her drugs for testing and was promptly arrested and charged with possession of a controlled substance. Now, why, oh why, would anyone fall for the idea that you could contact police to check your meth stash to see if it's contaminated with Ebola? Well, one reason, and one reason only: you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0350. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0350. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR in Nashville, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Before we go, we'd like to leave you with a helpful instructional message from the National Association of People Who Have Trouble Walking and Chewing Gum at the Same Time. Step, chew, step, chew, step, chew, step, step. Oh, God. I always screw it up.